This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, the business station. My name is Rich Bradbury. This is Geek Squawk. And of course, I am in the studio with Matt Armitage from culturepop.com.
Hey, Rich, how are we doing? Sorry, I almost forgot to reply to you then.
You
I was just like staring at my computer screen.
So, question. How much do we value our identity?
Well, this is one of the things, you know, we've never really been able to put a value on that kind of personal data before. Now, one of the things I talk about a lot on MSP is that I don't think we attach enough value to our personal data. You know, we give all of this information to Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and TikTok and all these other companies just to use their service. So a recent study has actually looked into this and put dollar amounts on the different types of information that people have.
Right. So
Scott Walston of the Technology Policy Institute and Jeffrey Prince of Indiana University, they did a study with 15,600 people. Now, they did the study across six different countries, including the US, Mexico, Brazil, Colombia, Argentina, and I think Germany. And they asked people how much they would need to be able to be paid in exchange for allowing ongoing aspect to different items of their personal data. Mm. And I'll be honest, I was really shocked by these findings. Participants asked for the most money for access to their bank balance, but that was only $8.44 a month on average. People would only demand to be paid $8.50 to give a company 24-hour access to their bank balance and their spending.
I'm in a similar position with you here, where why do you think people were willing to give it away so cheaply?
I have absolutely no idea. And that's actually the pinnacle. As you go further down the scale, I think it was $7.56 to share biometric information. That includes your fingerprints.
The thing you used to log into your phone and
in
your
and
bank
out,
balance.
Yes, you're happy to give a company access to your biometric data. Now, they did find that persons such as yourself and I over a certain age are more likely to attach more value to that biometric data. But it's interesting that people in these younger age groups don't see those, a retinal scan or those, you know, biometric markers as having any great value. When it comes to your location data, that went down to, I think, $1.82. Now, I'll be honest, I don't really have a problem with sharing my location data with a lot of services because I mostly go to my house, to one particular mall, and to BFM and a couple of other clients' places. So there's not a lot that can be learnt from my pattern, except that I'm extremely predictable and incredibly boring. So if somebody wants to pay me a couple of dollars a month for that insight, they are more than welcome.
Jackpot.
Yeah. One of the interesting findings that they made was that people in Latin America would actually pay money to receive ads. Now, I can't get my head around that one even remotely. I mean, I pay for so many services to remove ads.
Yes.
Now, off air, you said you would be prepared to give a company like Facebook access to some of your personal information, some more of your personal information, in exchange for not serving you up ads. Now, it's very interesting that people actually see, in parts of the world, people see ads as a value. Now, I don't know whether that's aspirational or, you know, they're living vicariously through
It
makes absolutely no sense at all. But what I think we are going to see, I mean, what this has helped us do, as I said, we haven't seen before people attaching these kind of dollar values to things. So it is interesting to see what people's thresholds are. So I guess the question for me is now, what value do you place on your personal data? How much would you demand for someone to have access to your bank account, for someone to have access to your fingerprints, for someone to have access to your retinal scan, or even something simple like location data?
I'd want a substantial amount, you know. Personally.
But so $8 a month wouldn't do it for you?
No, Matt, no. $8 a month would not. A couple hundred dollars. I,
Across for all of it or for individual?
Just for my bank balance. You know, you want to see my bank balance? Give me a couple of $100. I mean, I don't have that amount of money, that much amount of money in there.
I was going to say the $200 might be the the biggest thing showing up there.
But I've had a very similar discussion with Gen Zs and millennials or whatever you want to call them, whatever bracket they fall into. And I think part of this is just the fact that they've gotten so fatigued with this give me access to your data that they've just gone, you know what, it's just data now. You know, it's just become this ephemeral thing that they really don't care about anymore. So the very fact that somebody, they might look at this and say, well, okay, $8.44 for doing nothing, fine, without thinking that it's not doing nothing. There's all of this stuff that they're collecting information on you about, and they can pinpoint where you are and what you're doing, have access to all of this stuff, you know, for a measly $8.44 a month.
No, I mean, that is the astonishing part. I mean, I don't want
Are we just okay boomer? You know, are we...
I don't think it's that. I don't want to get sort of too deep and philosophical about this, but do you think there's even an element of kind of an erosion of a sense of self that you start to see yourself as a set of data points rather than
a
person?
For sure. Yeah. We're being lost in... We're not... But
it's like they're lost in the data flow. They've just become a part of the traffic or the movement of information.
This whole discussion of, you know, kids who've been born with the internet forever, since the date of birth, that they are part of that flow of information now, whereas we are arguably one of the last generations where we've had that separation of self and data.
But it's interesting, because at the same time you see in a sense with some of the younger generations I sound old now, but less of a sense like collective responsibility in society. So there's much more this kind of the idea of the pursuit of the individual.
Yeah,
but that runs contrary to this idea. So you would think that people of our generation would see themselves more as a part of the system and give up their information for the good of society or the good of the corporation. Yet it's actually the generation that sees themselves in much more of an individualistic way that is prepared to give up that information for very little monetary gain. Mm-hmm.
I know. My mind has been baffling over this very same discussion and argument for the past couple of months, and I cannot get my head around it.
No, it's a very difficult thing to grasp.
We should take a break. You are listening to Geek Squawk here on BFM 89.9. When we come back, we're going to be having a little chat about brain activities, antidepressants, and some other stuff.
Yeah, the usual happy stuff.
Yeah. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Books, figurines, movies. BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
BFM 89.9, The Business Station. My name is Rich Bradbury. I'm in the studio with...
Matt Armitage. Oh, I have to say my own name. That's really weird.
Right? It's good though, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Does Jeff let you do that?
No, he doesn't.
Right, there
and
you
I'm
go.
Quite glad he doesn't, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah, I feel very Trump-like now.
Oh, no. Right, before the break, we were speaking about data and owning it and how much it's worth. Something a little bit different, though. You said we had a happy story next.
Well, it is kind of a happy story. This is actually... So this is a combination of artificial intelligence with improving mental health. Mm. Now, this is an AI that can actually predict from your brain waves whether an antidepressant is actually likely to help you, because a lot of people don't respond very well to antidepressants. We don't really know why. One of the thinking behind it, I think a guy, Amit Etkin at Stanford University, said is often because, you know, we look at these diseases by... their result by the behaviors that they actually cause. A psychiatrist decides that you're depressed because you tell them that you're depressed. They don't really know what's actually going on in your brain. They're just trying to use these verbal and behavioral cues to get an idea. So they're actually prescribing you the medication based on very little information.
Yeah.
So Etkin wanted to find out if he could use machine learning to predict from your brain activity whether you would be likely to respond to treatment with the antidepressant sertraline, which is one of the most commonly used drugs. But it's typically effective in only around 1/3 of the people who use it. So they used EEG brain recordings showing the brain waves of 228 people, all aged between the ages of 18 and 65, of course, all suffering from depression. These people had all been on antidepressants at some point, but they weren't currently using drugs at the start of the study, presumably because the drugs themselves would affect the readings and the results. After those readings were taken, those first readings, half the participants were given sertraline. The rest were given a placebo. They were then monitored over 8 weeks with these readings used to measure any changes using, you know, the usual depression rating scale. What they found out was the machine learning was actually able to identify specific patterns of brain activity that were linked to whether or not sertraline would be helpful. So they had tested the algorithm just to, you know, blind study the results. So they used a different group of 279 people. Now, only 41 of those participants responded well to the sertraline. Amongst the people that the algorithm predicted would respond to the drug, it was up to 76%. So you see that rate in the general population of 33% rising to 76%. So that's already a threefold almost increase in effectiveness. As a result, Etkin has started his own company called Alto Neuroscience. He's going to develop the technology further, and he hopes that it will be able to be used by doctors to prescribe better medications in the future. I'm imagining that he will probably widen it beyond that particular drug, the SSRI sertraline. And yeah, I mean, it's something that it does need more work to see how we use it for people with depression. But these are really kind of positive results, especially as we're seeing this massive uptick in people with mental health, depression, anxiety-related issues.
I think, and the other uptick of this as well, the very fact that fewer people will be prescribed a drug that...
isn't going to work for them as
isn't
well.
Isn't going to work for them. And but once you're on it, it's very difficult to come off of it as well.
Yeah, it is. And that process of actually finding the medications that work for you, for many patients with mental health issues, it can take literally years, because you go on to a drug for a few months, then you have to be weaned off it, then they have to introduce something else. That then takes another few months, then you have to be weaned off again. Yeah, it's a very, very difficult process. So hopefully this kind of prediction model could help to short-circuit that for a lot of people.
Final story then, what we've got time for today.
Well, we're heading off to Mars.
Yes.
Up into the sky. Now, a group called the Mars Society, they're actually holding an international contest for the best design of a city-state that can accommodate 500,000 inhabitants. Now, it's not the first time they've done this. There is it's not a massive prize. It's about $10,000. Nothing to be sniffed at, but it's generally academics and people in, you know, policy research institutes and that kind of thing that go in. So for them, it's not big, big money. Last year, they had a similar contest. They asked people to design a colony for just 1,000 people. MIT won that. Their team had a concept called Star City, and they divided it into five villages, which were each supposed to represent a continent on Earth.
Or a neighborhood in Paris.
Well, no, there's like 18 of them, aren't there?
Neuf, Pont-Neuf.
No, I used to stay in the 18th arrondissement.
Oh, did
there's
you?
There's loads of them. Ah. Loads of them. And then
lots
you get loads. Yeah, and then you get to the outskirts. Anyway, completely off the point. SpaceX's Elon Musk actually tweeted earlier this year that he can imagine 1,000 launches of his massive Starship. They could send maybe 100,000 people every decade to Mars. So it could be that you would actually need this million-strong citadel by the year 2050. One of the requisites for the competition, that your design has to be realistic. First and foremost, it has to be self-sustaining, because You know, you can't just grab out for whatever you need from Earth. It is going to take a long time to come in. So they're looking at being sort of self-sustaining in food, clothing, shelter, power. Obviously, you've got to produce all of the vehicles and transports and everything else that you need for a million people. So the only thing they want people to get from Earth will be advanced electronics, so kind of computer systems and that kind of thing. Obviously, they want to all the researchers to look into the sexy stuff, advanced robotics, artificial intelligence, of course, my old favorite, 3D printing, because that's going to be one of the mainstays as well, actually replicating the things and making everything on site. But also to make the best use of the resources that they already have on the planet Mars. Now, if you are interested in entering, the closing date, I think, is June the 30th. 2020. They're asking for 20-page proposals. And one of the reasons I say this is I went to the Archidex conference last year, and they actually had from some of the design schools, the architecture design schools, they actually had Mars feasibility studies from all the students putting together their own pods and city ideas. So, you know, this isn't kind of esoteric and out there. So, yeah, if you've been working on these kind of things in your schools and classes, submit your designs. It could well be that your plan for Mars's first million-person city-state becomes, if not a reality, then at least a theoretical possibility.
This is fantastic.
It's kind of fun, right?
It is. On that note, we're going to have to end with a song. Matt, what have you got?
We're going to end with the unparalleled astronomical classic by David Bowie, Life on Mars.
BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.